Welcome, Daniela. It is a great pleasure to have you on this podcast. To people that are listening today, my name is Farai Mundjoma. I am the founder and CEO of the Shasha Network. And on the Shasha Voices today, we are kicking off a very special series of conversations that we're calling the Shasha Pathways. And we're starting off with AI and tech. And today I'm joined with Daniela Masichetti, who is a senior researcher at Microsoft, who holds a BSc in electrical engineering and computer science, a master of science in neuroscience at Oxford. The BSc was from University of Cape Town, a PhD in engineering science, and specifically in computer vision and machine learning. Daniela has done incredible work in the social space with coding boot camps and endeavors, and something that she is going to get deeper into as we hear her conversation. The reason why we're jumping into this particular conversation with Daniela is because we have realized that there's a lot of opportunity that exists for young people from the African continent to pursue different realms of the STEM field. And Daniela has gone on a similar journey of exploration. And in today's conversation, we're looking forward to learning from her and receiving some of the wisdom that she has gathered on her journey to becoming who she is today. And without going further, Daniela, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much, Farai. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you so much for making time. I know it's in Australia now, and you've had to really manage your time zones to accommodate us. Today, it's a very interesting day for us because we're kicking off this series of conversations. So you actually get to set the tone for what the next speakers are going to be talking about. But I know your story. Our audience are probably on the edges of their seat looking to also understand who you are. And so to just kick off, would you please share a bit more about who you are? Who is Daniela? Where does your story start in South Africa? And what got you to where you are now in what you're doing?
Yeah, sure thing, Farai. So yeah, as you mentioned, I'm now based in Australia, but I started my journey in South Africa, in Joburg, actually. I grew up in Joburg. I went to a small school in the east of Johannesburg, and I was very lucky to have chosen to do information technology or IT in high school, and that involved learning how to program, and that I really, really loved. And so I think that really set the tone for then kind of everything that would come after that. I remember I think it was my final year sort of project in high school, I coded up a game of Monopoly, which I remember we had almost like the whole term to do it, but I did it all in my holidays in like 1 week because I just became sort of so obsessed. Wow. With getting this game to work. So that was really fun. And I think, yeah, really cemented this idea in my mind that, you know, programming was what I was good at. Programming was what I enjoyed. And so then when I came to the end of my high school and, you know, finished my exams and started to think about what I would do next, I was really keen to make sure that computer science or coding formed some part of that. My dad actually is an electrical engineer. And so he was quite keen for me to go into electrical engineering. You know, he said, oh, it's a very good degree. And I believed him. But I was really quite insistent in, you know, also bringing this computer science aspect to the degree. And so when I was starting to look around for programs across the South African universities that were available, I happened on this particular program of electrical and computer engineering at the University of Cape Town. And when I looked into the course manual and the course program, I saw that it included or combined both an electrical engineering degree with a computer science degree or a computer science major. And so this really felt like the perfect bringing together of sort of that engineering mindset, that problem solving mindset, along with then my ability to kind of continue in the coding direction.
Just on that point, Daniela, what aspect of this was you being diplomatic to say, I still want my dad to like that, the fact that I'm doing electrical engineering, but I'm also going to do the thing that I like. Was there an aspect of that as well in that decision making?
I, think I really trusted my dad's advice. And so I really believed and trusted that, you know, an engineering degree was a very good degree to have. I also liked it because it felt really practical in the sense that, you know, if I got an engineering degree, there was many possible paths that I could kind of go down after having that degree. It's a very sort of flexible degree, perhaps in the same way that a business degree is. You know, you're sort of, if you do a business degree, you're equipped with a general set of skills that are then applicable more broadly, which kind of felt different from, let's say, studying law or studying medicine, where the career path is more directly related to what you study. So I think, yeah, there was maybe a bit of some sense of obligation, but I think I could also see the benefits or the perks of sort of having this engineering degree in my own way as well.
Amazing. Thank you for sharing that.
No worries. So I ended up applying for this degree, electrical and computer engineering at UCT. Fortunately was accepted to that program. And I was really excited, not only because it would involve me moving down to Cape Town. I visited Cape Town only once before, but I'd seen the campus while driving past, and it just looked like a castle. And I thought this would be an amazing place to study. It looked just sort of like a version of Hogwarts. And so I was very excited and, you know, moved down there at the beginning of 2010. Spent sort of 4 wonderful years pursuing this degree. I was quite academically inclined. So, you know, I really focused on my studies, really found the undergraduate degree quite stressful. You know, didn't actually do much extracurricular stuff at all, to be honest, while I was doing my undergrad. But as I was kind of nearing the end, of course, I was thinking, well, what is next? And I think a part of me was always interested in, you know, potentially pursuing a master's degree abroad. I'm not sure where I got the inspiration from to consider that as an option, but again, maybe I'll call on this idea of kind of wanting to study at Hogwarts. You know, I'd spent a lot of my, early teen years reading Harry Potter. And so basically anything that looked like Hogwarts, I was immediately drawn to. UCT was one example, but of course then the universities of Oxford and Cambridge in the UK were another example. And so I had this fascination with maybe visiting there one day or studying there one day. And I kind of thought, well, could I submit an application? Like, you know, what's the worst that could happen? I could just be rejected and at least I would have tried. And so, yeah, in my final year of the undergrad, I applied for some scholarships as well as submitted a formal application to a few universities in the UK, but Oxford and Cambridge were one of them. So the degree I applied for was a master's in neuroscience, and you know that may feel a little bit different or a diversion from the electrical and computer science undergraduate, but I think I was really intrigued by this this interest in understanding how the human brain works. I had done in my final year undergraduate research project, I'd done a project in computer vision. And so I already sort of had some experience in, you know, building these algorithms that could understand pixels automatically. And I thought, well, that's pretty cool. You can build these algorithms that can kind of teach the computer to see the world around them. But I was kind of interested in, well, how does the human brain see? Like, how does our visual cortex work? And so I thought this master's in neuroscience, it was kind of a one-year taught program, would be a really great way for me to to get a deeper understanding around how the human brain actually sees the world. And so that kind of motivated the direction of a master's in computer science. Very fortunately, I was accepted to that program at the University of Oxford. And so that involved then me moving over to the UK, just as I guess autumn was kicking off in the September of 2014. That was where a whole new adventure began, because of course now you're not only studying something, in my case it was completely new, completely different to what I'd studied before, but you're also kind of adapting and learning to a whole new way of life, a whole different country, a whole different set of customs and sort of social norms. And so that, while exciting, was of course also also challenging in many ways.
So on that particular point, Daniela, how did you prepare yourself for that transition? You know, because you had left Joburg, going to Cape Town, same country, a bit different. And now you live in Cape Town and coming all the way to the UK, you know, to Oxford. And you've mentioned things that, you know, people are kind of sitting down thinking, oh my God, if I have to go study in a different place, there are all these different realities that I have to face. How did you prepare yourself in that moment for that first transition into the UK?
Yeah, good question. I mean, I think the fact that I'd already spent 4 years living on my own, let's say, down in Cape Town was definitely a good primer. I already knew what it meant to do my own laundry, cook my own meals, manage my own sort of budget. So in some ways, I'd already had some degree of independence and some degree of life skills that I had learned. And so moving to the UK was then just taking, I guess, one next step, or it was, you know, kind of one step further, where, you know, now I was, of course, further away from home, further away from family. So it did involve some adjustments, of course. But I think what was really the driver or the thing that kept me going was the fact that, you know, it was exciting. It was this new adventure. It was this new, beautiful city that I was living in. And so it very much felt that, you know, even in the tough times or, you know, the moments where I was questioning, well, why am I actually doing this? It was, you know, I think the reason came from, well, you know, I'm doing this really exciting thing. This is an amazing opportunity. And so that really answered that question for me. But I think also definitely a part of my reason for considering UK universities was because of its proximity time zone wise to South Africa. So I always knew that my family was, you know, just 1 or 2 hours time difference away, very easy to call. And you know, I guess we leveraged quite heavily the sort of video calling technology that luckily existed. So I was always just a phone call away from family.
Amazing. Amazing. I can see so many themes, you know, how family has been a critical part of what you do and a very important support structure, but also this sense of wonderment that you've always had with Hogwarts and being in these spaces, which I'm sure, you know, part of your imagination at the time is like, hey, I'm in this space, which kind of mimics that Hogwarts experience. And I'm here for this adventure. I think you also need to have that illusion of fantasy when you're moving into a new place, right? Because when you get into the details of being in that place, right, the weather, the language, the all these kind of things, it's like, oh my God, I never thought this is what I wanted to focus on. But when you kind of leave yourself in the clouds a bit and just enjoy the beauty of being in Oxford and being in that space, It can be such a motivational factor to just making the first move and going there, and everything else kind of falls into place after that. So it is really interesting listening to that aspect, and even how before you went to UCT, you had visited the campus before. So in your mind, you're already kind of envisioning how you would be in that space. And I think that aspect of dreaming and fantasizing is really underlooked when people are making life choices, because human beings love great stories. They are very imaginative. And the more we tap into that aspect, that's where we sometimes derive all motivation and energy from. So it's interesting hearing it from your story's lens. And in our last conversation, you spoke about something to do with being an applied scientist, et cetera, et cetera. I want to hear more about that.
Yeah. So I began the master's, of course, just kind of wrapped up in this new adventure that I was on. But the funny thing was, is that almost immediately after arriving, people were already encouraging me to apply for PhD programs if I wanted to stay on, because of how the application cycle works. You pretty much have to apply, you know, kind of by December, January, and I'd actually only arrived in the UK or started the program in September. And so I thought, oh, well, that's pretty premature. Like, I don't know if I want to stay on for a PhD. But I was, I thought, well, it's a good sort of option to have on the table. So let me just submit an application anyway. And so I applied for funding and applied for a PhD position at the university. And I thought, well, I'll decide later, you know, if this is successful, then at least I'll have an option on the table. But interestingly, I didn't apply for a PhD in neuroscience. And that was because over the course of my master's program, it became increasingly clear that I was more of an applied, or I believed that I liked more applied science. So I was more of an applied researcher. And for me, neuroscience felt very much still fundamental, like fundamental, more of a fundamental research field. And by that, I mean, you know, I think what I was motivated by was being able to do some research and then see that sort of tech transferred into a real world application or something that kind of could get into people's hands. And neuroscience just felt like, you know, well, we're still 50 years away from that. I guess you have people like Elon Musk who sort of say different things, but it still felt that there was, you know, there's a lot of fundamental research that still needs to go in to understand how the human brain works before we can get to a point where we're building applications that are, you know, leveraging this research. And so because of that, I thought, well, actually, maybe it would be more suited for my particular personality and my interests to go back into a PhD in engineering. And in particular, back to an area that I had explored in my undergraduate, which was computer vision. And that actually, you know, spending, you know, 3 or 4 years of the PhD really diving deep into what computer vision had to offer would be a really interesting use of time. And I was really intrigued by that. And I saw very clear applications for computer vision, you know, from self-driving cars to medical imaging. And in my case, I was particularly interested in how we can leverage these computer vision technologies to build better assistive devices for people who are blind or low vision.
So before you go deep into that, you mentioned something because of my personality. What is your personality, Daniela?
I guess that's a big question, but I think, I guess the way that I knew that I was more of an applied research scientist was that I was always more interested in reading papers or reading, you know, articles on the web that were about like how this research had led to some product or some research had, you know, helped to develop X and Y and Z that was then used by people. I was much less interested in reading papers that were about just the research itself, where there was no clear connection to the real world application. And so I think a lot of my sort of curiosity and satisfaction was being driven by, you know, well, actually, I want to be part of a research field where I can sort of see that transfer into real world product. And so I think that very much guided my decision, or like guided my own thought pattern into like, I am an applied researcher rather than a, you know, a more fundamental or core researcher.
My question to you is, how do you reconcile this idea of being the person that wants to do the research that gets applied and creates stuff in the real world? So moving beyond what happens between your brain and your ears to what happens in the real world with your hands, how do you reconcile the idea that for some things to be built today, someone has probably had to be stuck in their brain and in the theory and philosophy of it before it gets applied? How do you reconcile that part of you that is practical to the one that is more philosophical and explorative? And, and is that even something that you think about, or you're just like, I'll let those guys that think about the long-term effects do that, but I want to be creating?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's all about timelines and kind of what timelines you decide to form for yourself. So I'm certainly interested in the more technical or fundamental aspects. You know, now I'm in machine learning, and of course, a large part of that is also developing new algorithms, new technical innovations. But I think ultimately what's important for me, at least, is always making sure that those technical innovations are guided by some real world application down the track. Now, that could be a real world application that you could develop right now. It could be a real world application that will only be realized, you know, in 5 years' time. But I think for me, being able to sort of at least say for sure that there is this real world application that this research that I'm doing now is relevant to, I think is really the thing that was important, that is important for me.
And this is what you've gone on to do now with your interest that you had, which we were just about to start talking about.
Yeah, exactly. So I in the end wrapped up this master's, and I think it was very clear toward the end of the master's that I just wasn't done with Oxford yet. It was obviously such a wonderful city to live in and be a student in. And so I was really, you know, I felt not done with this. And so I ended up kind of accepting being accepted into the PhD program and choosing to continue in that direction. And I think it was just, there was a lot of serendipity involved there, because as I was kind of entering this, PhD program in computer vision, this was in 2015, it was kind of just at the start of this kind of explosive growth in deep learning, you know, AlexNet and the CNN convolutional neural network had sort of come out in 2012. We were starting to see these massive gains in neural network based approaches. And so, yeah, it was just kind of serendipitous that I'd kind of started this PhD journey in machine learning and computer vision kind of at that time. And so I then spent the next kind of 4 years diving really deep into these methods, understanding them. And that was awesome fun, because there was, of course, a lot of excitement, a lot of cool things that these models could do. And yeah, I was kind of primarily exploring it in the context of assistive devices for people who are blind, which was really kind of this, you know, the application that was driving me.
When you were doing your PhD, what did your days look like? What did your interactions with the people that were supporting you with this research look like? Because for many young people that we work with, they don't even think about PhD, but it's a possibility for them. So how, from someone that has gone through that journey, what does that look like on a day-to-day basis? And how does someone prepare themselves and really think about the why of why someone would pick up a PhD program?
Well, I think, yeah, the first thing for me is you have to have that curious mindset. So, you know, a big part of the PhD and the skill that you kind of develop through the PhD is being able to really pin down the research question you're interested in answering. And, you know, part of that, I mean, that, of course, is a skill that you develop over the course of the PhD. But I think almost a prerequisite is, you know, you have to have that curious mindset that you bring, which is like, well, I am interested in formulating these questions. These are areas that I am interested in exploring. And so I think having that sort of curious mindset is definitely a first good starting point. But then, of course, over the PhD, you develop and hone that skill in being able to then get good at really converting an abstract, like I'm interested in X and Y and Z, into a really concrete set of research questions that then you go on to experimentally validate or theoretically prove or something like that. But I think, yeah, the day to day of the PhD was, going into an office space every day. We called it a lab, computer lab. It involved, you know, keeping up to date with research papers that were coming out fast and furiously, although not as fast and furiously as they're coming out today. It involved meeting with my supervisor about once a week, meeting with other collaborators, so other postdocs in my lab also about once a week, running experiments, writing code. And then eventually, once we sort of had some results from that, then writing that up into a research paper and usually submitting it to conferences primarily, but also journals. So a lot of also thinking about how do we tell the story of the research. You know, it's not just about running the experiments, writing the code, but actually, like, what is the motivation? What is the story that sits behind this research? Why is it important? Why should the community care? A lot of different components of the PhD for sure.
And so at the end of the PhD, of course, you know, if people either stay in academia or people go into industry. What did that look like for you?
Yeah, good question. So I was lucky enough during the course of the PhD to end up meeting a software engineer who was at Microsoft and who is blind himself. He works on part of the Seeing AI app, which is an app that Microsoft develops for people who are blind. And given that my PhD research was very much in assistive technologies for people who are blind, he was a great contact to have. And he ended up connecting me with some researchers in Microsoft Research in Cambridge. And it turned out that they had an open internship position. And so I applied for that internship position and was very fortunate to get that position. And so, yeah, at the very end, sort of in the final year of my PhD, just after I'd submitted my thesis and I was waiting for my defense, I interned at MSR. And that was a great, great opportunity. It was a great way for me to see how industry research worked. It was really, really interesting. And so, yeah, then once I sort of finished that internship, I went back, defended my PhD thesis, and thankfully passed all of those hurdles. Coming out of that, I then applied for a researcher position with the same team at MSR Cambridge and was fortunate enough to be offered a position with them. And that's pretty much where I've been since finishing the PhD. And this team focuses a lot on assistive technologies for people who are blind specifically, but also considers how AI technologies work more broadly for marginalized communities.
Wow. That's quite the journey, and congratulations on all the progress that you've made. And I really appreciate you taking time to really take us through that journey, you know, from when you first coded your Monopoly game to now you ending up where you are now, you know, doing all this research in AI. I understand that beyond your day-to-day work and, you know, you currently do work in Africa with the Indaba. Would you mind telling us about that and why that initiative is important, specifically at the time that we are in the continent and in the world in general?
Yeah, of course. So the Deep Learning Indaba, as some of your listeners may know, is kind of this grassroots organization that has started across the African continent to really drive research and development in machine learning and AI. I was lucky enough to join the organization as an organizer in its second year running. I was doing my PhD at the time, and I came across, I think maybe it was even something on Twitter, and I saw that there was this community of African organizers who were coordinating this machine learning conference in Africa, in South Africa specifically. And I thought, wow, this is like the intersection of all the aspects of me, the fact that I'm also doing machine learning, the fact that I'm also African and South African. And so I have to reach out to these people to find out what they're up to and like what this community is. And that was then really my introduction and my the moment where I joined the organization as it was one of the organizers, and spent the next 2 years kind of helping to coordinate then the Indaba down in Stellenbosch and the following Indaba in Nairobi. Which was great fun. And I think, yeah, the role that that community plays is just so important. We've seen the organization really grow from strength to strength. I mean, nowadays we're getting something like maybe even 3,000 or 4,000 applications per year to attend the summer school. And we're really seeing just such an explosion, such a growth in the talent and the, you know, the wide range of African scholars and students who are coming together every year at these meetups, both at the main Indaba event, but all the Indaba X events as well. And it's just really exciting to see, you know, see that growth and be part of it, you know, as the Indaba has grown alongside that as well.
Mm. And how, and in sort of like your application pool and your participant, how have you seen sort of like participation across people from different demographies, women, you know, young, like men, are we having more young women participate in AI and tech on the continent? What are the opportunities and scope that exist there? And what more could be done perhaps?
Yeah, good question. So the Indaba, from its very early inception, has always really wanted to drive inclusion both across genders and African countries. And so it's really a big part of the application and selection committee, which work tirelessly every year to make sure that the Indaba's attendees are as close to being balanced gender-wise as possible, which I think is really, really inspirational. But then also we aim to have representation from all of the African countries. I don't think yet we've had an Indaba where all African countries are represented at once, but we have had, we had many countries represented, and we're really kind of growing, aiming to grow our presence in countries that are not yet well represented. So that is a really important part of the Indaba's goals, I would say. But in terms of, I think where to next, I think obviously the Indaba will continue to prioritize this. But one aspect or one part of the Indaba, which I am organized, which I am involved with, is the Indaba's mentorship program. And so this is really about, you know, giving students the opportunities to come to be connected with mentors who come from a wide range of technical disciplines and discuss quite specific topics that they want to discuss, which I guess is maybe a bit different from other mentorship programs where the idea is you're having a more of an open-ended discussion. The Indaba's mentorship program is really targeted at helping mentees on a specific thing that they need help with, like they're busy writing a research paper and they want some feedback, or they're busy submitting an application to attend a university and they want feedback on that. I'm really excited to see that program grow as well. And I hope that that is a good resource for the community to draw on.
Amazing, amazing. So it seems like you're such a very busy person. You know, you're doing research in your job, you're building Indabas. What do you do in your personal time? You know, what content are you consuming? How are you spending your downtime? You know, what does that look like for Daniela?
Yeah, good question. I mean, I think because I spend so much time sitting at a desk and sitting in front of a computer screen, I usually like my downtime to not involve any screens at all.
Okay.
So I do a lot of swimming. I really love swimming. And I also do a lot of reading. I try and actively stay away from the Kindle, even though I do have a Kindle, because I really like the feeling of a hard copy book. And I also like a lot of kind of DIY sort of creative endeavors. And again, I think that's because it's something that I can kind of do with my hands, you know, without having to
look at it's a practical screen.
Yes, exactly. And so, I've done a lot of, you know, crafting, various kinds of sewing, you know, clothing design and so on. I do enjoy that in my spare time.
And so what kind of books are you currently reading, or do you usually read?
Yeah, so sci-fi and fantasy are my go-to genres. Mm-hmm. I think previously I felt it was a bit guilty reading those genres because it just felt so indulgent. But I think during the pandemic, I realized that life is too short for that. And so I have gone sort of deep into sci-fi and fantasy since the pandemic, and have really just enjoyed the downtime and the escape that comes from reading stories about these, you know, imaginative worlds. I really enjoy that those genres.
Amazing. So last question, and then we can definitely wrap up this conversation. There's so much that we've gotten from what you've been sharing with us. Because you're into sci-fi and pop culture and reading, I'll ask you two questions. The first question is, which character in the pop culture realm do you relate with the most? And I'll give you some time to think about that one. And the last one is, what parting thoughts would you have for any young person who wants to end up working in AI and they're starting off their journey in 2024? What are some of the things that they should think about?
Good questions. So I think, you know, if we talk about sort of the characters that I've identified most with, I'll maybe go back to my old faithful Harry Potter references, because I really do feel like the characters in those stories guided a lot of what has come, you know, since those early teen years where I was reading those books. And I think if you ask any of my family members, they'll probably tell me I'm Hermione Granger. very goody two shoes. So perhaps that's the character that I'll reference. But in terms of my parting wisdom or parting thoughts, I think, there's a lot of change that's happening in the field of AI and technology at the moment, and that can feel overwhelming. But I think part of the challenge is really embracing that feeling of being overwhelmed and not being scared by it in some sense. Really going with going with your gut in terms of what is interesting. And I think that really is a lot of what drove me. Like, I wasn't really driven by, you know, what's going to make me the most money or what's going to, you know, what other people think I should do. It was really being driven by, well, I find this interesting. I'd love to spend, you know, the next 2 years studying this or the next 3 years deeply exploring this. And I think that interest, the fact that I kind of brought that curiosity and that interest as the first thing to the problem meant that, you know, any challenge or any obstacle that was thrown my way was surmountable because I had this, you know, this enduring kind of interest and curiosity that was driving me to tackle those hurdles. So yeah, I would say just bring that curiosity, and don't be scared of challenges.
Daniela Masichetti, it has been a great pleasure hearing your story, learning from you, getting to experience what you've been thinking over the past couple of years. Thank you for all the amazing work that you do. And we hope to keep in touch. And hopefully we'll send some of our Shasha scholars to apply for the Indaba at some point in the future. We wish you all the best in your endeavors. And hopefully we get you back on the podcast in the future.
Yeah, that'd be great. Thank you so much for having me, Farai. It's been a great conversation.